being a parent brings many blessings and stresses. And here's a memory of a repeated event which caused me lots of anxiety. This happens about a year ago, plus or minus a couple months, when Mike was about 2. He was starting to run, liking it, and also falling a lot. So it was so, you know, couldn't be the cuter thing in the planet for Daddy. He gets his legs and arms running. Daddy, I'm running. I'm running. But he was also tripping a lot. So I'd say, I'd be so excited and proud, but also nervous. And I'd say, yeah, Micah, let's hold hands and run together. No! No, I'd do it myself. I'd do it myself. And quite often, he was not picking up his feet well. He would trip on a crack and go down, couldn't get his arms up, and would hit his head and get raspberries. And then I feel like there's a knife in my guts because I feel so bad he got hurt, and I pick him up until he gets enough breath to let the big scream out. And Chris and I talked on and off forever, trying to figure out if it was overprotective to stop Micah from running anywhere but on soft surfaces, or if he needed to learn himself how to fall and pick himself up. And we tended to be in different camps on that, which I won't tell you who was where. But it was a tough call. So I want to start today by talking about parenting philosophy and techniques. And in doing so, I'm very aware that I'm walking on delicate and sacred ground. You could tell by my weak disclaimer giving the reading that I'm a little nervous. I know from the time they are very little until they become young adults and well beyond, parenting is complex with many difficult choices. Ann Holbert writes about the history in America of parenting philosophy, saying there have always been tension among recommended styles, the bonders versus the disciplinarians, the child-centered and the parent-centered, with the pendulum swinging back and forth, and most of us are a mix of different approaches. Many of us are trying to find healthy balance points engendering good dependence, independence, and interdependence in the family system and in the community. So within that context, what I want to lift up, especially this morning, is it's important for children and for all of us, as a matter of fact, to learn to fall and fail and have frustration in order to develop resiliency and strength. It's important to learn how to fail in order to develop resiliency and strength. Lately, now I read this stuff. I should have before as a minister, I know that, but now I'm reading the parenting stuff. And many folks are suggesting that the current generation of parents and teachers tend too often towards overindulgence. Psychologist Lori Gottlieb works with many young adults who are struggling with a lack of meaning or direction in their lives. And in line with her training, Dr. Gottlieb searches usually initially to see if the childhood involved neglect or abuse. But frequently, she finds herself looking back with patients, remembering caring and loving parents who gave them freedom to find themselves and the encouragement to do what they wanted with their lives. These patients enjoyed parents who drove for the carpools and helped with homework each night. The parents also intervened when a birthday invitation was not issued or when the child was cut from the soccer team. And they often tended towards talking through feelings when the children broke the rules instead of giving punishment or logical consequences. Young adults who received this kind of parenting when they were younger were sitting in Lori Gottlieb's office saying they felt empty, confused, and anxious. So one day, another question occurred to Dr. Gottlieb. Was it possible these parents had done too much? In graduate school, the clinical focus has always been on the lack of parental attunement and how that affected the child. It never occurred to ask, what if the parents were too attuned? What if the children were overindulged? What happened to those kids as a result? Well, education writer Alina Tugin is not alone. She says, yes, many children are overindulged, and the consequences can be problematic. So she's saying, trying to pose a solution, as the school year re-begins and children and teachers are putting up goals together of finding inspiration, learning, and growing together, one of the explicit goals should be to make mistakes. Together, this year, in church, we're going to make mistakes. And she says this is important because she really believes that we're raising a generation of children, primarily in affluent, high-achieving districts, who are terrified of blundering. They can't handle sitting with the discomfort of not knowing something even for a few minutes. And, of course, a lot of this comes from pressure in communities that are lucky enough to have the pressure. We have to get into not only college, but the right college. Have to have the best math teacher. We know Mr. Smith is the math teacher who's going to help you with on the path to the right college. We're going to have to achieve the lovely combination of extracurricular activities and the right course load and grade point. It's a lot of stress, and it's real. But children in this context are talking and showing that they're afraid of trying something new, of being creative, of thinking in a different way. They're scared to raise their hands when they don't know the answer. When it's a difficult problem, they're hoping the teacher provides the answer instead of offering up a possible route to the answer that might have mistakes. So what these children and all of us, I'm sure with regularity, need to be reminded of, it's good things happen with people who can go through mistakes. They say that the best films are made on the cutting room floor. You put together version one of the film, you cut it. Version two of the film, you cut it again. Why do you think I sing in the middle of a sermon? It's because I want to inspire you all with my failures. This is a thought. I'm thinking out my sermons ahead of time. You know that. We know people who, in retirement, go into writing classes or painting classes. They're not doing it because they know they're the lost Renoir in the rough necessarily. They're embracing a process which will have ups and downs. Don Kinland is a child psychologist at Harvard, and he warns of parental discomfort with children's discomfort. If the parent doesn't get comfortable with the kid being uncomfortable, the kid is not exposed properly to pathogens. The kid needs to fight off the pathogens of failure and develop resiliency. It's a psychological immune system. And these kind of problems are in all socioeconomic classes in our country, I believe. Studies are showing overindulgence in public school systems where families have low income levels, schools where 25% or below of the kids are below the appropriate aptitude level, and 75% of the kids are graduating, are not doing any favors to the students. If a kid thinks that true D-minus quality work is really a B+, she is not going to know how to function well in the work world, in an office setting, or in relationships, in a neighborhood. We all, wherever we come from, have to remember in a kind way that frustration can be a precursor to learning. But if failure is not an option, that catalyst may be gone. And then maybe you don't like the word failure, you can substitute a different word. What's a different word that she could use? But when, what's that? Challenge. Difficulties. People who don't learn how to deal with frustrations when they're young are usually not good at coping with the big level frustrations when they do come, when we get to be big people. But if we learn how to deal with those tough turning points when we were younger, we can do better when we're older. Reminds me a couple of years ago at a conference, I was in a small group of ministers and we were getting to know each other. One guy was talking about his story and he said that about 11 years ago, I got a divorce. And that turned out to be the best, worst thing that ever happened to me. He said that he and his wife went through gut-wrenching pain for the benefit of the kids and themselves. They had tried everything they could think of to make the marriage work, but eventually they realized they just had to let it go, wish each other blessings, say goodbye. And looking back now, the man feels that that divorce created the circumstances for something better in his life. I'll bet you he learned early how to deal with challenge and difficulty. We have to let each other go in order for us to grow into self-reliance. In his seminal essay, Self-Reliance, Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "The relations of the soul to the divine spirit are so pure that it's almost profanity to try and interpose help. Each person lies in the lap of immense intelligence, which makes us receivers of its truth and agents of its activity." So we each are in great direct contact with the divine. We each are in the lap of a great innate intelligence, but we have to be allowed to connect with that and act off of that on our own. So I think that there are trends in parenting which are overindulgent in the United States. I think the same is true about our Unitarian Universalist congregations. I think ours is not alone. We are connected to the greater culture of Unitarian Universalism, but I think we've been too worried about hurting each other's feelings and not let each other grow strong enough and let our churches grow strong enough in empowering the leadership from within us. And see, here's another good news from this sermon. I'm going to let you be frustrated with me if you disagree with this line of analysis. I'm not going to try and protect you from your feelings of anger if you don't like what I'm saying. I'm going to let me fall or whatever. The other good news is that we can work on this towards these balance points. This is about balance in our lives. So spiritual exercise of the week that I suggest for you. Everyone's paying attention now. Kent, spiritual exercise of the week. Yes. What is it? Comes from a great preacher, teacher, Barbara Brown Taylor, who talks about how we can learn from losing. And this is from her book, An Altar in the World. Take a sheet of paper and draw a line on the bottom. One end of the line, write your birth. The other end, write today. Then chart the significant events of your life, which have made you who you are. Reflecting on the graph, you're likely to note that the spikes in your pain bear some relationship to your leaps in growth. She says that it might be when your family moved for the fourth time in 5 years that you learned to enjoy your own company in the months before you had any friends at all in your neighborhood. It might have been when your parent left you that you remembered what else you meant to do in life beyond staying together. It might have been when the doctor called about the spot on your lung that you finally made up with your sister. I know a lot of ministers, when we get together, talk about how we hear cancer survivors who reflect upon cancer time as having taught them that even in the midst of intense suffering, life bubbles up, offering joy and radiating light. These are not the things that you would have chosen for your path to become more who you are, but they worked. A woman named Brenda says it this way: when you can't control the wind, adjust your sails. If you're going and it's just pounding you in your face, you look like that dust, redirect, maybe turn it around completely, or at least go sideways. I know the story of a man who I admire very much, who experienced a big change in his winds and had to adjust his sails. This man and his family moved to a new city, in order for him to take a new big job. The job went bad due to dysfunction and unhealthy culture in the workplace. He left the job and used the opportunity to tap into passion and skills. His new consulting company, which he established, is successful and rewarding. And he now feels that he is using his gifts in the best way possible and more than ever controlling his own destiny. I think if he wouldn't have learned how to be resilient through ongoing pains in earlier life, he wouldn't have had the capacity to navigate as well now. The same can be true in many different situations. Morgan Freeman, one of our beloved actors, lives in small-town Mississippi where he grew up experiencing scalding racism. But he now feels relatively comfortable living in small-town Mississippi, and he's dedicated to embracing the positives of that culture and making a change. The small town where he lives for years had a segregated prom in the 2000s. In like 2006, they were having the blacks had a prom and the whites had a prom. And Mr. Freeman said, I think we can do better. And he funded a new integrated prom, and he actually made a movie out of that where 13 students talked about their experiences of getting their tuxedos and their flowers and making their arrangements. And they reflected on the history of the town, the pains of the segregated racism there, and how this was a new way that made them feel better about their lives going forward. And Mr. Freeman says he thinks that the pain that all of those residents, including kids, were feeling is a good catalyst for this positivity. He knows that bleakness can help new blessings arise. Ancient Persian mystics spoke these truths. Rumi said, the wound is the place where the light enters you. USG member Kathy Sheeter Bonanno has written poetry with similar scriptural wisdom. This is the stubborn sun, choosing to rise, like it did yesterday, like it will tomorrow. You have nothing to do with it. The sun makes its own history. Light has its way. Light has its way. We want to be supportive in helping each other open up to the light. We sing, lean on me. When you're not strong, I'll be your friend. I'll help you carry on. But we don't want people leaning on us too long. We don't want to lean on each other. Let this be a time of opening up, giving shade when we need it, but letting each other feel the kiss, the beloved kiss of sun, and we can all engage in a strengthening photosynthesis of the soul. Blessings be. Amen.